three features that make the stepstep house a pool. First one, that's a pool. It includes every teaching of the Buddha, sorry. The second feature, easy to put into practice. Third feature, comes down to two great lineages, okay? From enlightened beings down to us, okay? Now we're in the middle of the third feature. Jatankapa also said, the teacher of this line is the first Lama, first Dalai Lama also said, Zamling Kepa Yogi to the Yen, Yabba Mendona, Hagiwa, Tudu Tongine, Lun Shin Du, the teacher of the Lama, Jumba Ni. Then he said, they were crowning jewels of all the sages here in the world. They were people whose banners shone in glory of their fame in the world. They are Ludu and Tope. Who's that? Are you going to the That's our Master Sangha. Okay, from the 3rd and the 4th centuries, respectively. So generation by generation, those two great teachers, teachings on emptiness and on compassion, have come down to us. Legyu is a nice expression. Legyu means a pure lineage, unbroken, pure lineage. Okay? So it has been an unbroken and pure lineage for almost 2,000 years, okay, from those two great masters. And then last night we made a big deal about how the teachings that came down from Aryanagarjuna kind of implied the teachings that came down through Master Asana, right? Meaning, if you understand emptiness, then you can really have bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is a Buddhist idea that it's possible for any one person to contribute to saving the entire world. Okay? That you can have a vision of helping the entire world. Any one of us, with the correct ammunition, can make a difference in the entire planet. Okay? That ammunition is understanding where the world really comes from. And it comes from us. Really comes from us. So just, you know, my lamas challenged me after much fighting, struggle. They said, you go start a business in New York. Okay? You go help start a business in New York. And I didn't want to go, and I struggled against it. I really didn't want to get involved in business. And they forced me. There's a newspaper article, there's a gossip column article that says I bought all these expensive suits. I was forced to wear a suit, literally, by my teacher. And we bought it at Goodwill, okay? It was a dead man's suit. So I was forced. But we built a $250 million company, right? Just using these ideas with no other training, no other business training, nothing, no interest. If you understand where things come from, you can design your life. You can have everything you want happen in your life. And then you can make big changes in the world. You see, for example, with money, if you understand where it comes from, you can have as much as you want to help other people, right? Then people will come to you and they'll say, why do you always have money? You always have enough money. Say, because I give away money. And then they'll try it, right? And then you have to say, I give it away, but I give it away with a certain technique that you have to learn. And then they say, teach me the technique, and you teach it to them. And it always involves giving help to others, making others successful. So what would happen? You see, everybody in the world is trying to make a living, right? There's 7 billion people. those who are not independent and wealthy, they are doing something to make money. And they're all doing the wrong thing. They are working. Okay? And they're competing with other people. To make a living, 7 billion people are mistaken in the way they get their daily bread. Okay? And what would happen if you could begin to spread a philosophy that says the only way to make a living is to make sure others are well fed and taken care of? See, what if that got to be the viewpoint of people on the whole planet? Then the poor would be immediately comforted by everyone else. People would be rushing to Africa to help the poor. You see what I mean? And the whole balance of suffering in the world would change. There would be, it would be like a mandala, and that's bodhicitta. And you cannot imagine it unless you understand where things come from. You can't talk about bodhicitta, and you can't claim you're going to help the world if you don't know that thing about what you want. You must first provide to someone else. Okay? If you don't know that rule, you cannot change the world. If you do know that rule, any individual can help to change the world. Okay, got it? That's why it's so cool that these two lineages are married in our media lineage, the Dalai Lama's lineage. You know, those two ideas are married in this lineage. You, if you understand where the world is coming from, you can save the world as an individual. It's cool. Got it? Okay, stop saying no, it's not okay. Deitam techa sumo dita bhutte dita bhumi tenju nundoki mun nubato begin la ang mechi yuki gyapo dam sama dita la ang mete. These three features are not possessed even by such great texts as Maitreya's Ornament of Realizations, Abhi Samaya Alankara. Have you seen that lately? Like last Monday? This last Monday. We studied it, okay? Take that book by that we studied on Monday for like 8 hours. Everyone was, me too, my eyes were glazed over after. And then, or the Fel Samadhupa. Fel Samadhupa means the Guhya Samaja Tantra. Okay? One of the highest tantras. You can take those two famous scriptures, one of the ultimate presentations on emptiness, and one of the highest tantras in existence. They don't have the three features that we just mentioned. Which one are they lacking? Number one, do they include all the teachings of the Buddha? Not really, okay? Implicitly, what do you know? It's implied, but it's not directly taught in those texts. Okay? They are incomplete because they were meant for people to eat as dessert to the main course. Okay? Tantra comes later, after you have the main course, right? And same with heavy teachings on emptiness. Do they have the second feature of the long realm? Are they easily put into practice? No, they're not. Do they possess the third feature of having in them those two great lineages? They do, okay, but they're not direct. They're not directly stated. In the case of the Abhisamana, they're not directly stated. In the case of the Guhya Samaja Tantra, also not directly stated, but implied. You can't practice Tantra without those two ideas either. Because tantra means that you also are coming from seeds, and you could become someone who changes the entire world. You don't have to be a normal person. You are also, the reality of you is flexible. Okay? Alright. They don't include, those two works don't include all the teachings of the open and secret instructions of the Buddhist. Samgyurupa, Somachip on Nebo. And they don't directly treat the practice of taking your own mind. And we said Dulwa, right? Dulwa means to tame your mind, control your mind. And I gave the example of
a horse.
A banana.
A horse.
It was a banana. The horse might have been a banana. I don't know. No, I was talking about being at the coffee shop, and you know, I had a banana because I knew I was. I took a banana to buy it. Then I was hoping that I would break down and eat something else. So I was standing there with the banana, and I'm looking at all the other things which I'm not allowed to eat. You know. And the lady kept asking me, are you going to buy the banana, sir? Are you going to buy the banana, sir? And I'm like, you know, trying to find some rationale to eat something else. But I couldn't find it. That was a kind of self-control. That's not the kind of self-control we're talking about here. It's not. Okay? This self-control of the mind means we gave the example of your husband criticizing you, and that when your husband comes home in a nasty mood and says something mean to you, at that moment you need self-control of the mind. What form does it take? Be calm like a Zen monk. No. Okay? Look at your husband criticizing you and think about where he's coming from. Why is he criticizing you? And then remember that he is coming from seeds in your own mind, which were planted by you when you were critical of someone else last week. Okay? Then you don't have to control your emotions. You can't get angry if you know it's your fault. Alright? So there's no control of the mind doesn't mean don't get angry when someone punches you. It means look at them and understand where they're coming from. And you can't get angry. It's not controlling anger. It just cannot come. Okay? And that's the only way to ever stop anger. The teachings on the steps of the path treat that subject directly. Those other two books don't. You won't see the Guhya Samatha Tantra talking about a husband who complains. Okay? Nor will you see Maitreya's text on emptiness talking about the husband directly. But in this book, you will. Alright. Chama Shinam Kechen Chambo Sunda Sundi Gome Kiyama De Pape Chanjit Nagi Nanda Vipabu Na Ta Sam Gong Sun Chiba Yube Kyal Sam Vipabu Ka Panam Panam Reta Chomit Sam. Okay. So right now, you have a chance. We are about to step on to the teachings on the steps of the path. It possesses those four high qualities, the first of which Master Chandra mentioned. And it also possesses the other three qualities. So there's four in this thing. We covered before a while back. Now we're on the three. But anyway, they have all seven. This teaching has all seven qualities. Okay? So it really is a fantastic source, resource for us. Nitabula, Tirsam Gongsum. We have a chance to turn some gong. Okay? Say turn some gong. So sometimes Sarah May is not called Sarah May, it's called Tinsan Gong Ling, a jeweled island where you may undertake the practices of turn and some and gong. What are they? What's turn? Study. Sitting in this class right now is turn. Turn means listening. It should be to listen. Some go home and think about it. Or go to Paradise Cafe with your TA, which you should be doing because it's under homework. And talk it over with your friends. Right? That's contemplation. Thinking about what you heard. You can do it on the way home in the car. You can do it on your throne at home. And then go. Go means then meditate on what you come up with in your contemplation. Do a daily meditation on that. Internalize it. Make it part of your being. Chösamgong, Sunche, we get the Kelsang, the Kelsang means, Kelsang means a very, how do you say that? Golden days. These are the golden days. We have a chance. All of us here, we have a chance to talk about this scripture. We have a chance to try it out. We have a chance to practice it. These are golden days of our life. These are precious times of our life. And you will appreciate it later. I used to sit in Battle Mountain and tell them, this ain't going to last forever anymore. And they're like, yeah, yeah, here's the life. Not everybody's waiting.
Yeah.
And I tell you too about this, the 10 years will pass in a flash. And you will regret every class you didn't come to. Okay? This is a unique opportunity to hear the whole lineage. And it will pass. And karma will separate us. So while we're together, learn. Tawika, Tana, Tana, Re. Chokwein, San, Re, Tsimne. Don't be satisfied with something less than this. Okay? Don't go looking in the New Age newspaper for some shaman's hibiscus. Come on.
Ayahuasca.
Don't waste your time. This is complete. Everything you need is here. It's not as fast or as sexy as ayahuasca, but it's more, what do you call it? It lasts longer. It's something you can have for the rest of your life. The other thing wears off after a few hours. Then you have a really bad headache, I guess. Don't be satisfied with anything less. Go for it. It's going to take a commitment. It's time. And it's going to take some mental stretching, right? And it's uncomfortable to think new ideas. But it's worth it. Okay? It's worth your time. It's worth 10 years of your life. And you're lucky to get it. Vigilance. Nambir. Chimba chimba ju. Shin to kelchang. Shin to kelchang. So it's goddamn important that you listen carefully. You know? And you concentrate. Okay? And come. Okay? Don't miss anything. Shin to kelchang. Do all. Dugong, end of section. We're moving on to a new section. So we have completed demonstrating how wonderful this teaching is and why you should be so excited to learn it. Sanjay Suma, that brings us to the third topic, the third great topic of this scripture, which is Chawa Ninen Ichula Nyenshin Jita Chawa. So the very Nyenshin Jita Chawa means, how should you learn this scripture and share? How should you teach it as a student? What is the proper way to learn it? And as a teacher, what is the proper way to teach it? So I sent out an email, last week, 10 days ago. I sent it to everybody I knew that I could remember was teaching these ACI courses and the DME courses. Because, and I wrote in the letter, I said, look, when I started teaching, I had already been living with Ken Rinpoche for 10 years or something, right? And he had an etiquette and he stuck to it. He was very old-fashioned. He ran things the old way. We were in Washington, D.C. Someone gave him the money to study English at Georgetown University. So we went down there and we stayed at a Sri Lankan temple. And I would drive him every morning to Georgetown in his broken down Volkswagen Beetle. And then I would drive him home and I would wait for him. So then I took him to class one morning. Here's this little, monk, red monk going into the classroom with all the English as a foreign language students. It's very cute because they're all like 20. He's like 60 already. And they had a good time with him. They had a whole like fun time going on in this class. It was very funny to them. It was very strange to them, of course. And then the first night he came home and he said, I said, how did it go, Rinpoche? He said, I love everyone's really fun. You know, we had a good time. And then he hands me all these books and papers and he says, here, they gave me homework to do. You know? And I said, well, Rinpoche, in America, I don't know about Tibet, but in America, the students should be doing the homework. He says, no, you do it for me. And I'm like, well, Rinpoche, that's not how it's done. You know? And he looks at me. He levels those eyes on me, steel gray eyes, you know, and he says, I'm your teacher. And to him, that was all you had to say. You know, he couldn't understand why a disciple would ever say no to their teacher about anything. And that to him, that's just three words, right? And that was the end of the conversation. I got him to do the homework eventually. But then I grew up with that, right? I grew up with that. And I got used to it. And then I came to love it. This honor, this code of honor between the teacher and the disciple. I came to really cherish it, you know, because it's a bond. It's a heavy bond. And it's an iron tie between two people. And the whole etiquette with which you attend the teaching and the propriety of the teacher's actions and words, right? So etiquette from the disciple's side and propriety from the teacher's side. It was beautiful. And I didn't grow up with it. I learned it from him, right? It was imposed on me. At first unwillingly, and then later I came to love it. It's honorable, and it's beautiful, and it's proper, and it's pure. You see, then you know, I finally got whipped into this code of behavior in a class. Then I went to teach in New York. Then I remember it was on the Upper West Side. And I walk in, and these people are all sitting around. Two of them are laying down like this, you know, and chewing gum, and like, you know, they don't get up when I come in, they hardly look at me. I'm like, okay, everybody repeat Sunday, you know, and they're all like, you know, this, and then somebody's looking out the window. Nowadays, I guess they would be texting in the class or emailing in the class. And I didn't know what to do, you see? I was I didn't know what to do because it felt like if I explained the proper etiquette in a class, it would be self-serving. They would say, oh, he just wants people bowing down to him. Or, you know, he thinks he's a big shot, you know. And Americans don't like that kind of thing. You know? They don't like, they want people to be informal and sort of happy-go-lucky and you can chew gum, it's okay. You know, and like that. But I thought I didn't know how to tell them how fun it was to be honorable in class or to be, you know what I mean? To maintain a certain conduct and etiquette in class and how beautiful it would be to teach that way also, you know, with certain self-imposed standards of excellence. You see what I mean? And I didn't. I gave up. I didn't try. So for, I don't know, 8 years in New York, 9 years, I just taught the courses and people did all kinds of strange stuff. And somebody threw a glass of stuff at me one time. And, you know, I didn't say anything. You know? But in my heart, I said, if I ever have students who become teachers, and I'm going to volunteer to go tell their students how to act. Because granddad can come and tell the grandkids. It's kind of self-serving if the teacher tells them, right? The teacher tells them, you have to bow down when I come to class. It sounds like you're trying to be a big shot. But if I'm like granddad who only shows up once a year, then I feel like I have to, you know, it's okay if I yell at this, their students and tell them what the score is. So I wrote to all my students who have students, and I said, let them at least tune in. If they don't come, they should come. But if they don't want to come, if they're too busy, then ask them to tune in this week. And I'll teach them the proper way to take classes from you. And then they won't feel like you're taking advantage of them. Okay? It was a half of a trick. Okay? It's halfway a trick. Because the second half of these instructions is the proper conduct for a teacher. Okay? So I tricked them. I said, your students may want to watch this. I'm assuming they will also watch it if their students do. I don't know. But there's also a protocol or a correct way of teaching. There's a code of honor for teachers also. There's a code of honor for disciples. And there's a code of honor for teachers. And it is always taught first. You don't start teaching until the students know it. So in the long run, you don't start teaching until the students know the proper code of etiquette in the class. And until you as a teacher have reviewed the proper comportment for a teacher, proper behavior of a teacher. So this is something I think is very valuable for our group, because so many people are becoming teachers, and you have your own students. So I'll cover this, and then you can pull out the audio and leave it on in your center after you leave, or something like that, you know? And so I'm going to go through. They say that if you follow the etiquette, the protocol properly, then when you get to the steps of the path, they will stick in your heart. And if you don't, they won't. Okay? So you have to teach people how to listen properly and how to teach in an honorable way. Okay? These things are necessary, because if you don't cover it and you don't follow it, these steps won't stick in your heart. You can hear them, you won't be able to practice them. So it's considered very, very important to cover it from the beginning. So as a teacher, if you start out with some new coyotes somewhere, you got to find some excuse to teach them the protocol when it's ready, when they're ready, when it's comfortable. Okay? If you start too soon, they'll think you're just trying to, you know, get them to, they'll think it's a cult or something like that. Okay? And then when they're ready, you should find a way to teach them how to listen to a teaching properly and how to give a teaching with honor. Okay? So here we go. There's that Shinto again. What's that Shinto? Very, really. Okay. This particular subject is crucial if someone's going to learn from you. Dapo Gongchen Nawa Dapa, there's a lama named Dapo Gongchen Nawa Dapa. He said, Shen Yin Lam Yu Tong Yin Ne Bin Ni, Wan Lu Dampa Chok Yin Che Pan Sun. People of our lineage must learn to treasure and cherish the instructions on how to listen to a class with correct behavior and how to give a class in an honorable way. Like, people of our lineage should consider this one of the most precious things they have, this code of conduct. Okay? Why? It is the ne. What's ne?
A crucial point.
Ne means like a crucial
point.
In the study of Tantra, and in the study of yoga in Tantra, it's the teaching on the crucial, marma hatha, right? Marma means Marma comes from the word mur, which means to kill, right? Like mortuary or murder or mortal. And marma is the Sanskrit for name. Name is, marma means the what do you call it? If you stab the guy there, he'll die in 10 seconds. The fatal, there's a word. It's like, I don't know. There's a word in English. Like if you hit it, the guy, you press, James Bond presses here, and then you
call it. Pressure points.
Crucial point is the
right pressure points.
No, it's more like, it's also a place where you stab the guy. Mortal, fatal, anyway, vital point. Anyway, marma means that. For the study of spiritual things, this is the killing point. Whether or not you succeed turns upon whether you follow proper etiquette in the class. Okay. On the subject of killing, a coyote. The line yesterday night that I didn't know, okay? Right? I said it had something to do with yaks. It said, I have slaughtered the yak of the Dharma. And it was so weird I thought it was a mistake or something. Okay? It says, I have slaughtered the yak of the Dharma. It means the entire Dharma is a huge thing, right? But if you study the long rim, well, once, then you can slaughter the whole yak of the Dharma, right? It's like all the teachings of the Buddha, hundreds of thousands of books, are as big as a yak. But you can beat the whole thing if you just learn this little book. You can kill the big yak of the Dharma, okay? Anyway, back to this text. Chesumatara. Whether or not all of the steps we're going to learn for the next 10 years stick in your heart depends on this subject. So in Buddhist countries like Tibet, the calendar is mostly lunar. There are times of the month which are more auspicious and times of the month which are not so auspicious. The time of the waxing of the moon, which is from the new moon or the dark sky up to the full moon, which is called Yarmo, is considered a very auspicious time to do anything, okay? Because the moon is right. The moon is expanding. Then from the 16th on to the end of the dark moon, is considered an undesirable time to do anything. Generally. And there's also a big emphasis in Tibet on Tendel. Tendel can mean, those of you who are studying Tibetan, Tendel can mean dependent origination. But it has a completely different meaning, which is like an auspicious start to something. So, you know, if you're going to build a building in Tibet, you wait until the first of the month, because that's the best day to start. All things are started on the first of the month, important things. If something goes wrong during the consecration of a building on the first of the month, all the rest of the 2 weeks to the full moon are considered polluted. And then you shouldn't start the building. You should wait till the next first of the month. Okay? If you screw up the first 24 hours of the month, then it's going to be a bad one. Okay? So what he said here was, everybody knows if you mess up the ceremony on the first, it's going to be screwy till the 15th. Meaning what? Don't study how to study. Don't study the proper etiquette for taking a teaching, and don't study the proper conduct for a teacher. And you've messed up the beginning of the study for 10 years, and it's going to go bad for the whole 10 years. Get the first part down smoothly. Cover the first part carefully, and then the whole 10 years will go smooth. Got it? Did I have like a second? Okay. Chumat. It's difficult to have a marma about the whole process of the whole 10 years if you screw up the first subject. Marma meaning like vital spot. Like, it's not going to go well if you mess up the beginning. You got to get the beginning down soon. Ena vilasum. Therefore, we shall now begin the instructions on the proper way to take us to take a class and the proper way to teach a class. We will cover how to listen to a teaching. We will cover how to give a teaching. And then then there are certain things that the disciple and the teacher should do together when the class is finished. And we'll cover that. What do you guess that is? Okay, you do that already. You know about that. The whole assumption, how to take a class properly, has three divisions. So, before Baboka Rinpoche can teach you the proper etiquette for taking spiritual study, okay? By the way, spiritual study and geography in high school are different. Okay? This is a whole different thing. It looks like a class, but it's not a class. It is a transmission of the secrets of the universe. Okay? It's not a regular class. And this is aimed at helping you from the moment you die on. Its greatest benefits kick in as you die and get bigger after that. And so it's not like your sixth grade geography class. This is a different ball game. Okay? How to honor a teacher and the teachings properly. And then actually how you take a class. What is the method to take a class? So he's going to start out with why formal study is useful. Okay? Formal spiritual study is useful. Okay? And you know, in our, in America, there could be a school of thought that says, just take me into a cave and meditate with me. Don't say anything. I can get it. I don't need 10 years of book study. Book study. You call it book study and you think it's not the same as going on retreat and closing your eyes for 4 hours. And you think somehow this is less than that, right? Or somehow this is too, it's too scholarly. This is a scholarly exercise and it's not a spiritual exercise. So he wants to correct that impression. Formal spiritual. In my 3-year retreat, I started ballet. I started to study ballet. So I got very interested in ballet. I was 50. Okay? And I read a lot of books about ballet, mostly by Russians. And there's a good teacher in Moscow ballet, in Moskva. Right? And he said, he was talking about Baryshnikov and Nijinsky, these guys, and he said they must be highly talented to start with. They must be extraordinarily talented people when they walk in the door. They must be 1 out of 10,000. He glanced at some guy, I think it was, who's in the Miami Valley? Now he's the director, a boxer, former boxer, Spanish, Edward he was a child when Valentine got him. And he glanced at him and he said his left foot is a quarter inch shorter than his left leg is a quarter inch shorter than his right. He glanced at him. and said his left leg is according to shorter, like that. So he wouldn't be like a Baryshnikov, but he turned out okay. And so when they walk into the studio for the first time, they should be already extraordinary material. And then they need formal training, or they'll never be great, you see? Then they need thousands of hours of formal training. And it's the same with spiritual things, okay? You can have a great, aptitude for spiritual things. You can be great material, but then you've got to take that material and train it. And then you can get in line. Then you're unbelievable. Then you're extraordinary. Okay? You can be a person who is naturally drawn to spiritual things and who has a high talent for it. After that, you need formal training, and then you will be extraordinary. But you need both. You need formal training. Here we go. Deyam tomar chen, chen ma che dun chen ma ke ma la te pe pe yu sa ma shin du gyo che. At the beginning of a course of spiritual instruction, you should explain to your disciples why learning is useful. Why training, formal training is useful. Painting like a samba, tempala shintu, toshu kewe. If you are careful to explain to your disciples why formal training is so cool, then they will have a deep, what do you call it? They'll be excited to do it. They'll want to do it. They'll be turned on to go through a formal course of study. Yin? Penning sangwa. Therefore, you must do a sales job on learning, on formal spiritual study. And you know the difference. Those of you who've been to Diamond Mountain, those of you who went to the ACI courses, I think now you know the difference. I mean, you meet a person who's good and who has a good heart and is a nice person and has not had training, especially in the pen thing. And then you sit with them for 20 minutes and you're just feeling like they're blind. You feel like you're sitting with a nice blind person. Because you can see their future. They won't be able to go where they want to go because they don't understand the basic things. They have good instincts, but it's not enough. You need to train those instincts. Then you're incredible. Then you can help the world. Mm-hmm. There's a book called A Collection of Teachings on Spiritual Learning, the Process of Spiritual Learning. And you can hear its poetry, okay? It says, if you engage in formal spiritual learning, you will learn what actions you should avoid if you want to reach your goal. Formal course of spiritual instruction can help you learn the traps to avoid. With formal learning, you learn to eliminate the things in your life which are not going to help you spiritually. And we'll talk more. And if you engage in a course of formal study, spiritual study, you will reach Nirvana. Then you can reach Nirvana. If you engage in spiritual learning, you will learn Lung Thor. Say Lung Thor. Lung Thor. Lung means the things which you should do, and Thor means the things which you shouldn't do. I grew up in the Christian church, not far from here. And what was it they said? I have done those things which we ought not to have done. And I have failed those things which we ought to have done. And there is no help in this. It's a very beautiful confession verse. But it's like, I did the things which I shouldn't have done, and I didn't do the things which I should have done. And that's Lung Thor. In a nutshell, that's Lung Thor. If you train with a good teacher, you learn what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing. Okay. 남들 내 컨디션. 너의 내면이 된 신이. Any begins after this, and then we'll take a break. All of the Buddhist trainings can be divided into three great groups of trainings or scriptures. They are called baskets or pitaka. There's three of them, so it's called tre pitaka or tre pitaka. Okay? Tre pitaka. The three baskets. These are three great groups of Buddhist teachings. All the Buddhist teachings are divided into those three roughly. Because there are three trainings, right? There are three things you need to learn. Here we go. If you study Vinaya, okay, Vinaya. Vinaya means the art of vowed morality. Okay? Ethical lifestyle, which is taken in formal vows, is called Vinaya. It could be monks and nuns, it could be lay people with vows. You don't have, Vinaya is not restricted to monks and nuns, okay? Dewe Benyuki Din Shene, Shakut Suchung Dilapa. If you learn that subject, you will learn how to live an ethical life. How to make good karma. What are the things I should do? What are ethical and what is not ethical? Then you will be able to avoid mistakes in your behavior which would hurt you because they hurt others. That's the first great division of the Buddhist teachings, Vinaya, ethics. Second division. There's a group of scriptures called the Sutra Basket, the Sutra Pitaka. Generally speaking, any teaching given by an enlightened being, which is not Tantra, is Sutra, open teachings. But when you talk about the Sutra Basket, it refers to a smaller group within those teachings called Sutra. The basket of sutra is one part of all the sutras and tantras. Okay? If you study that, you can learn Tingen Zen. What's Tingen Zen?
Single point concentration.
Meditation. Okay? Deep meditation. Single point meditation. If you learn the basket of sutra, you will learn how to meditate properly. Concentration. Namyang so dumayin pupong. And you will be able to eliminate things which have no value. He's using the quotation that I gave before, which said, by learning, you learn which things have value and which things do not have value. That's a reference to meditation. The third basket of Buddhist knowledge is called Abhidharma. Abhidharma. Higher knowledge. Here it just said Mumma. Just said Abhi. Don't yawn very big in the class because it's hard for me to concentrate. You can like pretend you drop something and yawn at the ground. Okay. Rumi Lingit Din Shini, Sharati Lapa. Then, from the Abhidharma section of the teachings given by Lord Buddha, you can learn where the world really comes from. Wisdom, the training of wisdom, where the world really comes from. This is not the same as the lowest of the four great schools of ancient India, which is also called Abhidharma. And the Abhidharma Kosha is their main scripture, and it is the only scripture principally used in the southern Buddhist countries, like Burma or Sri Lanka or Thailand. Okay? He's not talking about that Abhidharma. He's talking about all of the ancient teachings of the Buddha, which mainly treat where the world is coming from. That basket is called the Abhidharma basket. Okay? Higher knowledge. Based on that knowledge, you can Yongong Pang. and you can reach nyangan like that. You can get rid of your negative emotions, and then automatically that is to reach nirvana, chepanyu. So we'll talk about that and we'll take a break. There's a flow here. Ethics, meditation, understanding reality. There's a flow here. You need to start with ethical living. You have to live a clean life. You have to live a good life. You have to be kind to others. You have to make good karma. The whole path begins with kindness. When you are super kind to other people, you make incredible seeds in your mind. And then you are able to meditate. People say, what's the key to meditation? Don't hurt other people. Be kind to people. That creates seeds in your mind. They create peace of mind inside of meditation. It's cool, right? The training on the basket of ethics leads to the training on the basket, in the basket of meditation, right? Sutra. Denial leads to sutra. Ethical living leads to the ability to concentrate and meditate. If you see a person who's being naughty in the Buddhist religion or any other religion, they can't be praying successfully. It's not possible. Or meditating. They can sit there and they can close their eyes. But if there's something on your conscience, you can't meditate. It's not possible. Okay? They can say whatever they want or they can look like whatever they want, but if they are being mean to other people, they don't have the karma to concentrate. If you're ethical, living a nice, clean life, helpful life to others, and then that helps you meditate, then you can turn that big gun on reality, where the world comes from, and you reach the third basket, which is the understanding of where things are coming from. For example, your husband, right? Don't ever take all this stuff as philosophy. Kind of dumb aside. Apply it immediately to your kids or your husband or your job or your boss. Don't ever let it stay in this room. Don't be shy when you're teaching people, saying, you got to follow ethical living at home with the kids, no more yelling, like that. Then you can meditate, which I'm sure you're doing every morning from 9 to 9:15. And that will enable you to have the focus of mind to deal with your husband. When he came home last night and complained about the spaghetti, okay? You shouldn't just get up and teach, oh, Vinaya, Abhidharma, Sanyasa, Sutra, Tripitaka. That drives me crazy. People say, study Vinaya, Sutra, Abhidharma, Tripitaka, and you'll reach a Shanta and Vipassana. And they haven't said a single word of English. Okay? Like, talk about spaghetti and your husband and the kids, because that's what it's for. The book was meant to be used for the rest of your life, for the other things in your life. It wasn't meant to be what you do. You don't study your whole life and then don't do anything. It's just a guidebook to how to live. But if you spend all your time studying and you don't live, then that's the point. You're supposed to apply it to something called your life, your relationships, in your work. And if you're just looking at books all day, it's like reading Julia Child and never cooking. Which is weird, right? What do you do? I read Julia Child. Oh, questions. Do you have questions? There's a microphone. If you don't, we'll just keep going, but if you have a question, you want to ask.
I was wondering, what seeds did you take to that plant that led to Chinese invasion?
Yeah, good question. Okay. It's a combination of answers. Okay. What is that? Don't But you should understand that a lot of the people in the monastery don't understand what we've been talking about. Right. So that's one thing. I mean, Rinpoche studied at Gyorong Kongsen within Serame, Gyorong College. It had 500 monks. Only two of them could write. Okay, so it wasn't the case that everyone really understood about the seeds. They may not have gotten the teaching in the manner that you got it. Okay. Which happens with things when they get old. Like, also it happened with the Christian church or the Jewish faith. I mean, things solidify, things freeze, they become creeds. People don't remember how it works. So, there's a lot of monks who don't understand these things. Then, there was a lot of abuse in Tibet. The government abused people, the monks abused people, the monasteries abused people, the monasteries owned most of the land. The lay people were tenant farmers mostly on monastic lands. And if it was a benign monastery, you were a benign serf on your own land. And if it was a nasty monastic authority, there was abuse. There was abuse. The political system was abusive. The prison system was abhorrent. There was a lot of torture. And like that. So there were bad things going on. And it wasn't all a happy Shangri-La thing. Even given those problems in Tibet, I would say that the monastic system of learning and practice is the highest institution in this planet. Okay? Even with the abuses that were done by some people, I believe that any Tibetan monastery was the highest spiritual institution on this planet. Okay? With the occasional abuse. But even then, they were and continue to be shining lights in this world. If you live in a monastery and you study in a monastery, it's the happiest place in the world, okay? And it's the most beautiful place in the world. Okay? So both are there. You have to be honest about it. Right? Then lastly, some people will say, you know, there's a joke in Tibet that Mao Zedong saved Buddhism by killing a million Tibetans. Okay. He pushed Buddhism out into the world. And you and I wouldn't be here if there had not been an invasion of Tibet. Dalai Lama was seen in public once a year for a few minutes in a parade that went to Lhasa. Okay? He spent the rest of the time in the Potala Palace and no one ever saw him. So to have a Dalai Lama circling the world and teaching constantly is unprecedented in history. And that's because of the loss of Tibet. Okay? That's a popular view to express. I don't adhere to it. I think if the seeds had been, this is the make a path out of a disaster argument. And I don't like that argument. Okay? I would rather have the path happen without the disaster. You see what I mean? I would rather, you know, that there had been some, I don't know, Tibet started to export dharma along with turquoise or something. You know what I mean? Like, just some happy event that brought Tibetans into the world, lamas out into the world. And I believe that it's a fallacy to say it's a good thing that a million people died because it got all the lamas out in the world. Currently, if the seeds had been planted differently, the lamas would have come out in the world through some happy event. You see what I mean? So I don't buy the make a disaster into a nice thing argument. In the end, it's a fallacy. If you play your seeds right, there's no reason why you need to have a breakup to find your true partner. So you see what I mean? You would have found them anyway through some pleasant thing. Okay. So lastly, of course, any violence which we see in the world is ultimately a reflection of our own heart. The violence that we saw done in Tibet and being done, right? There are eight or nine monks that burned themselves in the last book. It's coming from us. It's coming from us. You can't blame a certain country or a certain people. Ultimately, it's coming from you. My Chinese friends, which I have many now, because I went, I was scared to go, but I went. Now I have many, many Chinese friends. And they look at me when I talk about Tibet and they say, when will you give Geshe Michael, I heard your house is in Rimlocker. And so I'm like, yes. I heard you live on a mesa. I said, yes. What's the name of the mesa? Rikyo Mesa. Who owned it before? The Apache and the Navajo. So will you give their land back? And then maybe we'll think about it. Then it's, you know, then we just have to. Anyway. Those are all things to think about.
How would you describe the difference between merit and karma?
I'm sorry, merit?
Yeah. Is merit a different karma or is it something else?
Okay. Merit is normally a translation of a Thai word called sunam. And then karma is lay. Karma can be divided into sunam, sunamayama, and dhammayama. Sunam means good karma. So when we say merit, we mean good karma. The interesting thing is the definition of good karma. Who wants to take a shot? What makes a thing good karma? If it produces for you personally a pleasant result, it was good karma. That's an interesting yardstick, benchmark for morality. Any action which results over time in happiness for you is good, goodness. And anything which over time hurts you is wrong. Okay? It's an interesting definition of morality. So sunamayama is, you can call it non-merit or something you do to hurt someone else. It's also a form of karma. So karma can be, in the Yoga Sutra it says, karma shukram akarshnam yoginas trividam itarisham, fourth chapter. Three kinds of karma, right? One is shukla, white, or son of merit, and one is ashukla, which is black, not white. And then pibidam means there's a third kind, which is, you can say there's a kind of karma which is sort of neutral. Okay. So there's good karma, there's bad karma, and there's kind of a neutral karma. Neutral karma means, you know, how do you feel about the rug? Pattern on the rug today. Like, it doesn't irritate me personally, and I don't like it much either. But to tell you the truth, I didn't think about it. But it's there. So it must be coming from my karma. Rug is there. Carpet's there. I don't feel much either way about that design. I don't hate it and I don't like it. So that's a result of neutral karma. So there's three forms of karma. And merit is good karma. And that's a long story. Fourth chapter, Amitabha Kosha. Spend a year and 2 months.
I had a question about how to present the teachings if you wholeheartedly wish to present some very simple teachings and considering the word seeds and potential, for example, to people who you really believe are going to be perhaps offended or really believe there will be a negative result to the point where there might even be I can't remember the way it was described yesterday, but a strong reaction against the teachings that I know could harm their karma. Do you think it would be more beneficial to give them what you feel is an appropriate teaching at the right time and with skillful means, and risk the possibility that they may then in turn create some very serious karma for themselves by dissing it? I'm talking about some family that is very, very strict in the Catholic tradition and has a lot of fear around what, you know, what I'm doing here, for example. But I still want to proceed in a way that could help them.
Okay. I think the first thing to say is that in the Buddhist tradition, we're not allowed to proselytize. So we cannot. That's why we do this prayer at the beginning of the class. That's a formal request from every member of the audience that I teach. And I'm not allowed to teach unless someone asks me. Okay? In the Buddhist tradition, you're not allowed to teach unless someone asks me. And then there's tradition to refuse to kind of say, I don't know anything, or I don't know why you're asking me. And then the third time they ask, you're allowed to teach, traditionally. Then there's a small fine print at the bottom of that contract in scripture that says, if you believe the person would be well disposed towards what you say and would benefit, and if you believe that they would be interested, even though they don't know enough to ask you to teach, you can initiate a conversation in which you teach them, right? So I'm starting from that foundation. We generally don't teach people who are not ready. And I think you know who they are, right? It's like I try to turn somebody on to a song. I say, listen to this song, you know? And then they start talking after 20 seconds. And then I'm like, they don't deserve my song. You know, I'm like, no, because they're not really listening to the song, you know? And then I just stop. I want to share my music with them, but I just don't. They just start talking, or they don't listen, or they start texting somebody. And I think, oh, I wasted that. For me, it was a beautiful song, and I wanted to share a quiet moment with them. But I don't, you know, like, yell at them and say, you didn't listen to the young rascals play Good Love. So that's one thing. I think it's worth the risk, okay? I think it's worth the risk. And I believe if you are well trained, you can present these ideas to anyone in a normal conversation without them knowing it. Okay? Like in the DCI tours, we have spoken in Indonesia to groups of Muslims. We have gone to Tel Aviv in the Geshe Theater in Yafa. 900 people came and we taught. We have spoken to members of the Communist Party in China. We've given talks to, you know, mafiosos in Ukraine, you know. And I haven't found anybody who, if you tread carefully and with great experience and knowledge, that doesn't start to think about how they could use it to make themselves happier and more successful. So I think it's very rare that nowadays that I find someone. It takes experience, right? It takes years of teaching, but then you can come to a language which is acceptable to anybody. And you must make the effort to speak in their language. You can't. We went out today with some representatives of the government of the city. One of them was into football, and he was just interested about football. So, you know, I like kick Haggerty under the table, and he starts talking about lacrosse. And then we're all okay. And we spend like 20 minutes talking about lacrosse and all Americans. And did you know the most successful lacrosse player in history is Jim Brown? He's a football halfback, isn't he? Anyway, so, you know, we spoke his language, and he was comfortable. And we went on to the deeper stuff later. So I think it's just a matter of practice. But never force it. Never force the mind, because it's counterproductive. If someone thinks you're forcing them to think something, they will resist you like a donkey. I used to work, not own donkeys, but we used to use donkeys in our long hikes. And once you start pulling too hard this way, they will go the other way. They won't stop. They won't, you can beat them, you can scream at them, you can do anything, it doesn't matter. They'll go the opposite. Because you're screaming. People are like that. If you're skillful, you can help anybody. Gentle and skillful. I think one more question.
If you created seeds to see the deaths of loved ones in your life, does that mean that you caused their death?
It's a principle of seeds that no one can plant a seed for someone else. It's not possible. Okay? So you can love someone deeply, and you can want them to not die, and you want them to live. But you can't give them a single minute of life. It's not possible. You cannot plant a seed in another person. It can only be planted by the person himself. You cannot share a seed that you have with someone else. It's not possible, good or bad. You can't share a good seed, and you can't share a bad seed. So no, it's not. What happens to any individual is only due to themselves. And it kind of seems just, right? Like justice. That happens to be the way it is. What's the Buddhist proof for that is that I went to the dentist last week. The Buddhist proof that you cannot share a seed is the fact that I went to the dentist last week and he drilled my teeth and it hurt. So you need no more proof than that to establish that it's not possible to share your seed with another person. You must plant their own seed. All you can do is teach. All you can do is explain. That person must take action themselves. You cannot do it for them. And what do you mean about the dentist? I mean, the argument in Buddhism is that there have been countless holy beings have been produced by the teachings and by other teachings, like Jesus or Moses or Muhammad. Okay. Countless high beings have come into this world. If it were possible to take seeds away from me, in their love and compassion, they certainly would have done so already. And I wouldn't have ever gone to a dentist. Okay? It's not like they were holding out on me. And when you're trying to follow a Christian path from a certain angle, it's very difficult to explain why God would make people suffer. See? If God could take away my pain, why would they? That's what got me started on the Buddhist path. I couldn't live with it. You know, I was signed up for an Episcopal Theological Center in Boston. I left. I never went. I just couldn't reconcile my mother's death, extraordinarily painful death, with someone who could have made it not happen, and chose not to. Even with the I'm going to test you argument. So just create people that they don't need testing from the beginning. Why make them faulty, then test them and then kill them, you know, when they fail? And I just couldn't deal with it. So I, you know, in this tradition, we say that no one can give you seeds. The only thing they can do is teach you how to do it yourself. Go to Starbucks. Identify what you want, find someone else who needs that, help them, go home and rejoice in the good you've done afterwards. And then you have to go to Starbucks. I can't go for you. I will if you want. You buy those little cards. No, you have to collect. I don't want more cards, by the way. I have dozens. I take a shuttle sometimes in the airport and I hand them out to everybody. So, because they stop on the way to Starbucks, so anyway. But you can, yeah, you have to encourage people to plant seeds. And then they have to do the work themselves. And somehow that seems more right to me. They have to earn their own liberation. And in we have friends, Hindu friends in the Bahamas. We go there and teach once a year. We teach together with them. And they always come back with, what about God's grace? You know, what about the question of grace? Is there no grace? You know, in your system, you have to do it all yourself, and there's no such thing as grace. And then I said, no, it's not like that. Get this, okay? If you have a heart teacher, if you have a heart love, and you serve them properly, as you are trained to do, that's why you need the study, right? As if you serve them properly and with your whole heart, and if you believe they are enlightened beings, then the karma of the belief is that they will be able to grant you grace and miracles can happen. Okay? But that also comes from planting seeds. Right? Miracles are possible. And grace, and the grace of a holy being is possible. So, such an extraordinary grace that it can short circuit and bypass all karmas you've ever committed. Right? There is such a thing. You can call that the grace of God. But you have to plant it. Okay, got it? It's cool. Miracles will happen. Lama can bring you back from the dead. Okay? You have to. You must plant the seed through your service and devotion to it. Okay? That's a nice place to stop. That's what I am counting on.
Alright. Got it. I'm not going to be able to do it.